dig. It's known as a digri jaya. It is a it's a progress of the four points of the compass around all of the kingdoms that are under your authority. You receive submissions. You're, in a sense, the ruler of the four quarters of the Hindu world. You control the Mother River Ganga. You will draw her sacred waters up in containers as symbolic of that. So it is not an effort to organize an effective kingdom, a bureaucratic kingdom as we would understand it. And as a result, in the 11th and 12th centuries, early 12th centuries, there were a series of competing kingdoms. In the Bengal were the Pala kings. They actually favored Buddhism, and their great monastery was at Nalanda. In the northwest, in the Punjab, in parts of Afghanistan, where the Khyber Pass was, the strategic pass into India, that was in the hands of devotees of Shiva. They ruled as the Shahi kings, the Shahi Rajas, actually taken from the old Persian term, Shah. Central India, in the Doab, that was a real free-for-all with different dynasties vying for control of the Aryavarta. And as a result, there was no organized resistance when the Ghaznavid sultans had begun to raid into India even before the Seljuk Turks were on the scene. And the crucial victories that opened northern India up to Muslim conquest were won by the Ghaznavid sultans, particularly Sultan Mahmud, the man who sacked the great temple in 1024, and he waged repeated wars against the Shahi rulers in the Khyber Pass, who broke through. He captured the city of Lahore, which gets turned eventually into a base for Muslim expansion. He still primarily thought in terms of plunder, but nonetheless, he had opened the main routes into India for future conquerors, for future Muslim conquerors, basing their armies on steppe cavalry. The other important feature that develops in the 11th century is that the Ghaznavid sultans increasingly realize that they really can't take back their domains in Iran or contend for the cities of Transoxiana unless they begin to settle, expand, and take over the regions of India. Now, in this regard, the conquest is very different from Asia Minor. From the very start, starting with Mahmud, the Ghaznavid sultan, down to Mohammed Ghori, who in the early Mohammed Ghori is actually a Ghaznavid general who goes into business for himself around 1173, and he is responsible for entrenching Muslim power in northern India. In 1192, in a very, very important battle at Tarain, just north of Delhi, his nomadic cavalry crushes the most effective state in northern India. This was the state of Prithvi Raj III, who controlled most of Rajasthan, Ajmer, Delhi. Those are the important cities in the Doab. In the next year, in 1193, his forces took Delhi. Those victories in 1192, 1193, as well as the victories of Mahmud, collectively had the impact of Manzikert in Asia Minor. It opened northern India to Muslim conquest and settlement. However, there are very, very significant differences between the two conquests. To be sure, they were contemporary. To be sure, both in Asia Minor and northern India, nomadic cavalry had proved its worth. They were able to defeat far superior armies depending on infantry. And in the case of India, large numbers of elephant corps, especially in 1192, when they defeat the armies of Prithvi Raj III, there's at least 200 elephants on the opposing side, the Hindu side, which are lined up with the infantry. And again, the swift cavalry managed to encircle and destroy that army, and the unfortunate Raj ends up being target practice for the Seljuk Turks after he surrenders. So militarily, in both instances, nomadic cavalry proved that they could conquer. They could defeat the far larger armies of urban literate civilizations. On the other hand, there were some very significant differences. The Turks, as well as their associated allies, largely from Khorasan, Persians from Khorasan, who acted as administrators, and Afghans, who were incorporated as part of the cavalry, they encountered in India a very different world from Asia Minor. This was not at all conducive to the settlement by Turkish tribes. Furthermore, the conquest itself had been conducted by men who depended heavily on slave soldiers, those Mamluks, rather than tribal regiments. And so from the start, it could be argued that in the 11th and 12th century, even into the 13th century, when we look at the Delhis of Sultan after 1206, to a large extent, the Turkish conquest of northern India is much more a military occupation rather than a settlement. And this is quite different from Asia Minor. We don't have the large numbers of people moving in and settling into India, the large number of Turks. And let's take a couple of statistics to bear that out. The best guess is that in 1071, when Alp Arslan won the Battle of Manzikert, Anatolia had some 12 to 15 million residents, Greek and Armenian speaking for the most part. The best guess is over the course of the 11th and 12th and 13th century, 500,000 nomads, men, women, and children, moved into Asia Minor and settled there. And in time, they would assimilate the Greek, Christian, and Armenian Christian populations. The majority of them would become Turkish speakers, and you would create a new Turkish identity in Asia Minor. Contrast that with what Mohammed Ghori got after his victory in 1192 at Tahrain. He gained control of Delhi. In fact, the sultans will make Delhi the great city of India. It was really a rather minor city up until that point. Nonetheless, he has essentially a military force, even if the migration of Turks was anything on the order of what we know in Asia Minor. He was facing a population 10 times the size of Asia Minor, Hindus mostly, but also Jains and Buddhists. Furthermore, you're dealing with 2 million square miles in the subcontinent as opposed to 300,000 square miles in Asia Minor. And above all, in India, the Turkish Muslim conquerors ran into the power of caste, Varna, into the great traditions of Indian civilization, in a terrain and a climate that did not permit the settlement of nomads. In fact, it wasn't even conducive to horses. One of the reasons that the Turks can win over the Indian armies is they have the same advantage that steppe nomads had over Chinese armies. Horses are not readily bred in the climates of India. There's just too many parasites, inadequate farmland, grasslands, and India depends not on horses and camels, but on excruciatingly slow bullocks, ox carts, with largely infantry armies and elephants. And so from the start, the sultans who come to rule in Delhi face a very, very different situation than their contemporaries do in Konya in Asia Minor. And as a result, two different distinct Turkish Muslim civilizations come out of these two conquests, which in some ways bear similarities in their initial stages, but will produce a Turkish civilization in Anatolia and a ruling elite in Delhi, and it could even be argued to some extent Islam and the Turks are absorbed into Greater India as just one more religion and a subset of caste.
Lecture 24, The Sultans of Rum.
In this lecture, I want to look at how the Seljuk Turks in Asia Minor made use of their victory, or victories, really, in the 11th and 12th century to construct a new Turkish civilization in Asia Minor. And this is going to be followed by a parallel lecture dealing with how Turkish Muslim rulers in Delhi at the same time in the late 11th and 12th centuries, 13th centuries, attempted to construct a new Muslim order in northern India. In effect, we're going to look at how well did the conquerors use their victory. Well, in the case of Asia Minor, I mentioned that up until 1204, it was really unclear what would happen in the struggle between Byzantines and Turks for possession of Anatolia. And I think in part the Turks succeeded because there were a number of factors in their favor, not only military factors, but the way Anatolia was conducive for them to settle in large numbers and to create a sort of nomadic society in Asia Minor, which would, of course, supply the military with lots of horse archers. But there was also another factor in the fighting, and that was the Byzantines themselves. I think they made two fatal miscalculations. The first was calling in the Western Europeans. This is well known ever since the magisterial work of Stephen Runciman on the history of the Crusades. There is a whole tradition of Western scholarship criticizing the Crusaders for turning their arms against the Byzantines rather than fighting the Muslim foe. And also it could be argued that the Crusaders distracted Christian efforts to Jerusalem rather than centering on the real issue, which was to take back Asia Minor for the emperors in Constantinople. Well, some of these criticisms are really a bit beyond reasonable, given the political perceptions and values of the time. But there was a deeper miscalculation besides bringing in Western co-religionists, and that was born of previous Byzantine experience with nomadic peoples. They had successfully converted the Bulgars, who had settled in the Balkans. They had made attempts to convert the Pechenegs, not with great success. The Magyars had been converted by Western European missionaries. And for the longest time, the emperors in Constantinople thought that the sultans of Konya, the Danishmend emirs of Niksar, which is out in northeastern Turkey, that they could be courted, that they could eventually be brought into the umbrella of Orthodox Christian civilization. And what they didn't understand is that when the Turks entered Asia Minor, they had already turned themselves into that distinct Muslim ethnicity that was Turkish in speech and in values, that had the traditions of the Ghazi warrior, and that these were married with a folk Islam, a dedication of jihad, even if jihad in many times was nothing more than an excuse to plunder the Christian neighbors or to attack monasteries and churches for the goodies. Nonetheless, I think the Byzantines miscalculated here. And in 1204, after Constantinople was wrecked by the Fourth Crusade, no Byzantine emperor was ever in a position to conduct anything like a serious effort to convert the Seljuk Turks. That means Konya emerged as a new capital on the plateau. And given the fighting that had raged for some 200 years over that peninsula, in the 13th century, Konya emerges as the center of Asia Minor, and therefore the center of a Muslim Turkish civilization. There's two points I want to look at, and that is, how did the sultans in Konya attempt to forge a wider unity once it was clear that there would be no Byzantine reconquest? Because Asia Minor was a kaleidoscope of various different competing Turkish powers, local emirs and sultans. It was by no means sure that Konya would be the power. And then the second question is, how well did the sultans in Konya succeed in creating a new Turkish civilization? Well, starting in the early 13th century, a succession of very, very talented sultans in Konya managed to expand control over the peninsula. The first of these fellows is by the name of Kai Khusro I. He happens to rule at the beginning of the 13th century when Constantinople is defeated. And down to his successor, Kai Khusro II, and there is a succession of different sultans of Konya, and he dies in 1246. He has the mistake of running into the Mongol army in 1243 that we'll get into. Most of Asia Minor was eventually put together as a single sultanate, recognizing the authority of Konya. And this was a considerable achievement, that the sultans in Konya were able to rein in the various nomadic tribes. They were able to join rival cities such as Sivas, Niksar, Konya into a single state. And the pivotal ruler in this is Kai Khusro II. He comes to the throne under some rather difficult circumstances. As I've mentioned before, the Seljuk Turks, being very, very good nomads, practiced lateral succession. And when his father died, Kai Kubdad in 1236, there was the usual dispute of exactly who gets the throne. Kai Khusro II had to deal with various half-brothers who thought of themselves as also entitled. And as a result, there were several significant civil wars that were fought across Asia Minor, and it ends in the unification under Kai Khusro II and eliminating those collateral lines. However, in the course of the fighting, the emir in Erzincan, which is today on the it's actually on the main earthquake fault. It's always being rattled by earthquakes. It really is on the northern route leading out of Asia Minor from the Kelkutchaya, that is the valley of the old Lycus River, into what is Armenia. His half-brother complicated the succession by appealing to various nomadic tribes. His name was Izzaddin, and also appealing to the Mongols. At this point, the Mongols were the major power in Asia. We will be discussing that. And Kai Khusro II has the misfortune that various insurgents sought refuge with the Mongols. Kai Khusro II refused to submit to the great Khan, that at the time would be Ogadai, who was the son of Genghis Khan. And in 1243, the Mongol governor in Tabriz, and his name is Beju, decided to intervene in Asia Minor. And a Mongol army came rushing into Asia Minor, and near the modern city of Zara, at a very strategic pass known as Kursada, the Mongol army smashed the army of the Seljuk Sultan. Kai Khusro II escaped. He went on to rule as a Mongol vassal for another 3 or 4 years. He died in 1246. But that defeat at the hands of the Mongols essentially ended the political power of Konya. And by the early 14th century, the various states in Asia Minor, the Muslim states, again fragmented into a whole constellation of political powers. We usually call them the Beylikler. Beylik means a domain ruled by a bey. Beylikler are the beyliks, that is, these lesser states. And that will be the situation in Asia Minor, really down to the reign of Mehmet II, the great Ottoman sultan, who will reunite Asia Minor as part of the Ottoman Empire. So in political terms, the sultans of Konya did not do particularly well in waging a wider political unity. There was, to some extent, there was never really a danger from the Byzantines. They had been destroyed by the Crusaders. And the effort to put together a fragile, effective central state among the various Turkish nomadic peoples in Asia Minor failed. And in part failed because, well, the institutions weren't there. And furthermore, the Mongols decisively intervened and essentially smashed a Seljuk power. Konya, in many ways, after 1309, is finished as a political center. It will survive as a religious and cultural center, which we'll be getting to in a moment. On the other hand, the sultans of Konya, in the 12th century, when they're still fighting the Byzantines, and then again in the 13th century, do score a major success in transforming Asia Minor culturally and religiously. That came in several forms. First and foremost was architecture. And here, the sultans of Konya had several advantages. When they arrived in Asia Minor, they already were heirs to the tradition started with Tuğrul Bey, the first great sultan back in the 11th century, of employing Persian administrators. The courts at Konya and the lesser cities such as Sivas, Amasya, Niksar, which were either ruled by cadet members of the family at Konya or earlier by independent emirs, they all favored the high Persian culture of Eastern Islam. Persian was the literary language that was used at the courts. Persian poets and scholars were appreciated. At the same time, they sought out architects and craftsmen from the wider Islamic world. And because they were Muslims and not just nomads who had settled in Asia Minor, these cities, the Turkish dominated cities of Asia Minor, become linked to the caravan trade ever more intimately, and more Muslims from the wider Muslim world settle in the cities and bring their skills and expertise. These are especially architects and craftsmen. And so there is an administrative and cultural talent that comes into Asia Minor that can be used to construct a Turkish civilization. In addition, the Mongol conquests, and they're going to form a whole separate part of the course, the Mongol conquests in the 13th century, starting with the conquest of Khorasan by Genghis Khan, clearly one of the great military campaigns of all times, drove increasing numbers of Turkish tribes and Muslims out of Central Asia, out of Transoxiana, out of Iran, westward into the Seljuk domains. And that brought many more Turkish settlers. Those included tribesmen. They reinforced the Turkish component in the peninsula, but it also brought mystics and scholars and poets, and above all, architects. So in the early 13th century, there were several significant developments now that allowed the sultans of Konya to undertake a massive rewrite of the urban landscape of previously Christian Byzantine cities of Asia Minor. Konya became a showplace for Seljuk architecture. There had been also earlier achievements of Seljuk architecture, particularly in the eastern cities today, in Erzurum, the ancient city of Theodosiopolis, in Sivas, in the city of Tokat today, and in Niksar. These are cities are in northeastern Turkey, the small caravan town of Divri. We see some of the earliest efforts at an independent Turkish architecture. In part, it represents the architecture of the Samanid emirs, but it also has distinctly Turkish elements. Take, for example, one of my favorite cities to visit in eastern Turkey, Divri, a Byzantine Phrygia. It's actually on an old caravan route, which now is no longer paralleled by the highway system. There's a new highway system, so it's a little bit out of the way. In 1229, there was a wonderful mosque-hospital complex built there, which is virtually untouched. There's no later building. It's a early 13th century Turkish monument. It's a gem. You have a tradition of a long hall incorporated with early efforts at domes, what is known as a squinch dome. Furthermore, the plain exterior is very, very nicely contrasted with the doors and the portals that show this elaborate sculptured, almost like a scalloped carving, these pillars. And this is all out of Turkish woodwork and textiles. And so you get the interplay of these elaborately carved doors against the simple surface of the masonry outside. And then when you walk in, it is an extremely inviting and pleasing mosque with lots of prayer space opened up by columns. And there are early minbars that survive, that is the wooden pulpits in the Islamic religion, which show marvelous carving, again, out of the nomadic traditions. You can see these minbars at not only Divri, but also in the museum at Sivas. A number of these Turkish minbars have survived from the 13th and 14th centuries. And so you get the construction of complexes like this. Madrasas, religious schools, they too are built across eastern Turkey. Çifte Medrese, there's one both in Sivas, another in Erzurum. Gök Medrese, it only survives with its minarets today. The building was very damaged, and they're doing some heavy-handed restoration. Nonetheless, steadily over the 13th century, the skylines of cities in Turkey are transformed into a Muslim skyline with medreses, with minarets, with mosques. And these are the first significant buildings in Asia Minor in over 150 years. The money for this is coming from the successful consolidation of the power of the sultans of Konya and also the Silk Road. Another monument that comes to characterize Seljuk Asia Minor is the Caravanserai. The Caravanserai is a camel rest stop, as it's sometimes called. They come in three forms, the deluxe, the medium, and the kind of cheap version. The deluxe version are the Sultan Hans. There's a wonderful one outside of Aksaray today. And that is a very, very pleasing building. Again, it is essentially a simple fortification. It has a chapel, a mechit, as it would be called in modern Turkish, for Islamic worship in the center of this courtyard. There's plenty of storage area. Roman arches have been deployed in a brilliant way to provide accommodations for camels and other types of beasts of burden. And these caravanserai were set up at crucial points along the way on the what the Turks would call the Ipek Yolu, the Silk Road. And caravans could stop there for up to 3 days, rest. They were supported by endowments. Fafuk is the Turkish rendition of that. That was usually Christian agriculturalists. And that meant the caravans had security. They could put their goods behind walls. They could not be attacked by brigands. They were under the protection of the Sultan. And that meant caravans arrived regularly and the Sultan could tax them. Lots of money came in there. The Sultans also get access to silver. And they coined the first significant silver coinage in Asia Minor, a very distinct Seljuk silver coinage, which begins to replace Byzantine money. So in the course of the 13th century, economically, socially, architecturally, the peninsula is being rewritten into a new cultural landscape. And the sultans and Konya are presiding over it. In the countryside, there is another architectural feature that points to how Asia Minor is being transformed into a new Seljuk homeland. And these are the memorial tombs, mausoleums, very, very simple, known as either a teke or a turbe. There's a great deal of debate as to the origins of these. I've mentioned them in conjunction with the Samanid emirs. You will see them again in the time of Tamerlane at Samarkand. And the climax of great memorial commemorations to rulers, of course, will be the vast building programs in Mughal India. But the teke and turbe in Asia Minor are very, very simple. Some would say they look like little mini Christian domes. Others would argue they're off the traditions of tents and stone. Whatever the traditions are, there are at least 3,500 that have been counted as having been constructed in the 13th and early 14th century, and they are Islamicizing the countryside. They are memorials to Hojas and Sufi mystics, Muslim holy men, or particularly pious individuals. At my favorite city of Divri, there are three of them that have survived, and they're in wonderful state of preservation. And those were places where Christian agriculturalists would be attracted by the religion. They replace, in effect, the traditions of the saints and the Christian tradition. And again, they represent a wonderful and ingenious variation of religious architecture by the Seljuk Turks, and it play a very, very important role in my mind in the gradual conversion of Asia Minor over to Turkey. So the visual arts give us one dimension into this, and they are being sustained by a very, very successful exploiting of the resources of Asia Minor and, above all, profits of the Silk Road. Well, there's one final ingredient in the Islamization, and we'll be investigating this ingredient, this issue in India in the next lecture, where, again, Islam is brought in by Turkish conquerors. Why does Islam remain a minority religion in India, whereas it wins out in Asia Minor and becomes the overwhelmingly majority religion in the peninsula of Asia Minor? This has to do with the power of the Hoja or the Sufi mystics. I mentioned them in connection with the initial conversions of Turks on the Eurasian steppes. Muslim holy men,